Just as Chief White House Strategist Steve Bannon is trying to keep his head down during a tumultuous few weeks for the Donald Trump administration, a new book examines the Breitbart News founder's relationship with President Trump and his voters. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJZT. Thanks for listening. I'm Ryan Bank, in for Melissa Ross. We're always live here at 9, and make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or through the WJZT app. You can also hear our audio feed on the First Coast Connect Facebook page. Just ahead, Bloomberg Businessweek reporter Joshua Green is here to talk about his new book, Devil's Bargain. Then later, a local lawyer expounds upon the continuing flap over presidential son-in-law Jared Kushner's security clearance and the millions in assets he inadvertently left off his financial disclosure forms. Plus, the ARC Jacksonville's new employment initiative. All of that ahead this hour, but first this hour. Joshua Green is a senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek and author of Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. Get on the line now with your questions for Mr. Green, 549-2937. The book probes the complicated relationship with Bannon, other parts of the president's inner circle, and 45's throngs of mostly white and male fans branded the alt-right. Give us a call again with your thoughts at 549-2937. Joshua Green, welcome to First Coast Connect.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with this online movement of, you know, what's been described mostly as disaffected young white men online. Most have heard a lot about the alt-right by now, but for those who haven't, what is the alt-right and what is the connection to Chief Strategist Bannon?
Well, there's no agreed upon definition of the alt-right, but generally it's thought of as being this kind of online group of trolls, of kind of splinter conservatives, some of whom are racist, anti-Semitic, that became really prominent during the 2016 election cycle, tweeting, you know, Pepe the Frog memes and all these sorts of things that nobody had ever seen before or really experienced in politics. And they were especially virulent and aggressive, going after journalists, especially Jewish journalists. But I tell the story in Devil's Bargain of how it was that Trump brought a lot of these people into the political process and into the 2016 campaign. And it's a story that actually begins about 10 years earlier when Bannon was a banker and wound up as the CEO of a video gaming company in Hong Kong. The company itself that Bannon ran didn't actually make video games. What it did was it tried to profit from a process called gold farming, which sounds absolutely ridiculous if you don't play video games. But what gold farming is you know, in a lot of these massive multiplayer online games like World of Warcraft, the way you advance is you win gold and you win special armor. Bannon's business hired low-wage Chinese workers to go into the game and play and win all this stuff, and then he would turn around and sell it to gamers in the real world for real money, right? So if you want to skip ahead a few levels with your special sword, you know, you can pay a couple $100 to Bannon's business, and it'll get you ahead in the game. And this was a very profitable business for about 2 years, but then something happened. All of the gamers who weren't cheating, who weren't buying their armor and gold, and there were millions of them worldwide, got very angry about what they considered to be cheating, and they organized online. They organized themselves on message board, and they went after these video game companies and said, you shut down this gold farming stuff. We're your customer. You're ruining our experience. And they succeeded, and it bankrupted Bannon's business. But the lesson he took away from this is that there are millions and millions of mostly young white males who spend hours, days, weeks absorbed in these games, and that if you're able to organize them, or if you convince them to organize themselves, they can be a very powerful force. And when he got to Breitbart News about 5 years later, he conspired to bring these people over into the political process, to Breitbart News, and he did that by hiring as Breitbart's tech editor a guy named Milo Yiannopoulos, who has become a very famous and controversial conservative provocateur. But Breitbart really became a home for a lot of these people, and when Trump ran for president, they became ardent Trump supporters and very aggressively attacked both his opponent and media figures who wrote about Trump and his campaign in anything less than a glowing tone.
Right. So, you know, this kind of brings up what seemingly looks like a contradiction here, right? Because you're talking about Bannon, a former banker, experience at Goldman Sachs. He was running this company doing gold farming, as you describe in the book and as you're describing now. But he doesn't, I mean, that doesn't exactly have the pedigree of someone who kind of has that working man's cred. So how does he connect to this, like, nationalist populism?
It's a great question, because everybody points out, you know, Bannon professes to be this kind of hard right populist blue collar nationalist, but he went to Harvard Business School, he worked at Goldman Sachs, and he spent time in Hollywood. I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find three more kind of elite cosmopolitan universes. But the answer to the story is in Devil's Bargain. I go back and tell the story of his origin. And Bannon was born into a blue-collar, Irish Catholic, Democratic Navy family in Richmond, Virginia. Wasn't very political growing up. Did a stint in the Navy after college and really became kind of radicalized there toward first Ronald Reagan and Reaganism. And later the kind of economic populism I think you see today. And I talked to some of Bannon's friends and classmates from the time who said, you know, he's always really been the same guy with the same politics, the kind of chip on your shoulder, poke you in the chest, kind of confrontationalism. But back then, you know, you tended to find a little bit more of that in the Democratic Party than you did in the Republican Party. And Bannon himself was a Democrat growing up and in college. What changed him was his experience in the Navy. He served aboard a destroyer that was in the Gulf right on the eve of the failed mission in 1980 to try and rescue the American hostages being held in Iran. And Bannon was so angry and so upset by what he considered Jimmy Carter's failures and the blow to America's honor and reputation that hostage crisis precipitated, he became this kind of Reagan-worshipping right-winger. After serving on the destroyer, he served briefly in Reagan's Pentagon.
Is that like a radicalizing moment for him, would you say?
It really was a radicalizing moment. And I describe in the book a scene Bannon told me about where, as a young Navy officer, he gets off the ship in Pakistan, and he's kind of horrified. You know, he sees these hordes of young Muslims. He said, you know, half the country was under the age of 16 at the time. Bannon described it as looking like the surface of the moon, Pakistan and Iran, that it was primeval, and he understood that a lot of these young Muslims were hostile to Americans. They were holding hostages. I think that was the moment that first sparked the Islamophobia that we see from Bannon. And then, of course, the bookend to that story is on September 11th. He's working as a banker. And the World Trade Centers get attacked. And so here was the same, in Bannon's mind, here was the same radical Islam that he'd encountered 20 years earlier in the Middle East. Now here it was in America, in the heart of the financial district where he himself had worked. And it convinced him that America and the whole Western world were engaged in a radical apocalyptic struggle against radical Islam. And these are the views that he's brought into the White House.
Give us a call with your thoughts at 549-2937. Again, 549-2937. Joshua Green, author of Devil's Bargain, joins us now. So I want you to kind of, let's fast forward here from his kind of the formation of Bannon as the personality that we know him today in media to when he first met Donald Trump. When was it that he first came in contact?
He has to leave.
So Bannon was brought into Trump's orbit by a guy named David Bossie in 2010. And Bossie is a longtime conservative activist whose specialty is going after the Clintons. He was a House of Representatives investigator in the 1990s, who was one of the most prominent people investigating Bill Clinton's various scandals. He went on to lead a group called Citizens United, for which the famous Supreme Court decision is named. And Trump had met Blasi at a charity ball. He's introduced him by Steve Wynn, the casino magnate, in about 2009. And little known to the outside world, Trump is getting serious about politics and seriously thinking about running for president, even though nobody believed him. And so he started asking Blasi to come up and advise him in Trump Tower. And one day, Blasi brings along his friend, Steve Bannon. I described the scene in Devil's Bargain where Trump and Bannon clicked right from the get-go. And the reason they did, I think, is that Bannon is at heart. He's a very charismatic guy. He's a deal maker. He had a lot of experience working and battling with high-powered moguls. He'd done deals with Michael Ovitz and Ted Turner. So he forged this connection with Trump right away that Trump didn't have with other advisors who tended to be more in the yes-men mold. As one of Trump's aides told me, Steve Bannon was the only alpha male in his universe at the time. And so Trump took a liking to Bannon and was very open to listening to Bannon's nationalist politics and Bannon's ideas about populism, about nationalism, about the supposed threat of radical Islamic jihad and the menace of illegal immigration. And many of the views that Bannon held then and holds now, I think he imparted to Donald Trump during those meetings and helped shape the candidate we saw emerge in the GOP primaries in 2015.
Well, Joshua Green is a senior reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek and author of Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. Mr. Green, we could probably take a whole hour or more to talk about this. It's a fascinating read. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Much more still ahead. Later, the ARC, Jacksonville's new employment initiative. But up next, we take a look at another member of the White House inner circle, Jared Kushner, and ask the question, should he retain his security clearance? Back in a moment.
What is sex education like these days? Many parents cringe when talking to their kids about sex, and many kids don't want to discuss it with their folks. Teen pregnancy is down, but the Trump administration is cutting millions from a prevention program. How should we teach teenagers about sex, and who should lead the lesson? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT. Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A, and I am coming to WJCT Studios for a free listening party for younger public radio listeners. They'll be featuring a Skype Q&A with me, thought-provoking conversation, and refreshments, of course. The event is on Tuesday, July 25th from 6 to 8 p.m. Registration is free, but you do have to sign up. You'll find more online at wjct.org/events.
Sponsored in part by Firehouse Subs.
The 121st birthday of Florida writer Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings will be celebrated with a fish fry on Saturday, August 5th at Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings State Park in Alachua County. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll visit Rawlings' home. We'll discuss Hugh Willoughby in the Everglades and Frank Evans in Lake Mary. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. In June of 2016, Jared Kushner and Donald Trump Jr. attended a meeting in Trump Tower with a Russian lawyer. She told Trump's eldest son she had dirt on the Clinton campaign, and an email chain later revealed that supposed dirt came directly from the Russian government. We're also learning this morning that Kushner met in April 2016, previously undisclosed, with the Russian ambassador. According to Trump Jr., that dirt never materialized, and although attending the meeting isn't inherently illegal, many say it's enough to revoke Kushner's clearance. Kushner is set to meet off-camera with the Senate Intelligence Committee today regarding the continuation of a probe into a possible Russian collusion during the 2016 election. Michael Stansky is a local attorney and has more on the topic. Michael, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, let's talk let's start talking about what a security clearance is. We hear this word, but there's a lot of different types of forms. And so what kind of forms would Jared Kushner be filing with the federal government as he began his work as a White House aide?
Well, at its very basic level, a security clearance is just a predetermination that somebody can access information. And not only do you have to have that predetermination made for the classification level that is required for what you're trying to access, but you also have to have a need to know. So there's a lot of misinformation about security clearances, and people believe that just because somebody is granted, for example, a top secret clearance, they have all of the access to all of the information at that level that the government holds, which is incorrect. As far as the documents that need to be produced, it's a monster of a document called SF-86. Sometimes it's electronically submitted through what's called the eQIP process, which is basically just like an online form that you have to go ahead and do exactly the same thing you would have to do on the paper version, but online. It runs around about 100 pages. It's incredibly detailed. It's going to go through every aspect of your life. And I tell my clients that pretty much if you have any question on your life or somebody has any question on your life after reading it, then they've probably filled it out incorrectly.
So we're waiting to take your calls here in just a moment. 549-2937. What are your questions for Michael Stansky, attorney at law, about Jared Kushner's security clearance or security clearance in general? So let's talk a little bit more about what the controversies here are with the son-in-law of President Trump. Obviously, there is a lot to unpack about this continuing investigation into Russian collusion. There's multiple investigations. What exactly is being alleged here? What is the illegality that's being alleged here by some of Kushner's opposition?
No, absolutely. And I think that the issues kind of break up into three pieces. The first piece is, there any criminal liability? And I think that the answer is maybe. And that's certainly going to take some more research by the Department of Justice. But he's a lot closer to breaking the law than he was a few weeks ago. And that mainly comes from a violation of making a false statement, which is codified in the United States Code at 18 U.S.C. 1001. The maximum penalty is a fine and 5 years in prison. So it's a pretty significant charge to be made. There are numerous examples of the federal government prosecuting somebody for falsifying their SF-86. So this isn't something that folks are talking about now because it has never happened in the past. It happens, and it happens at all levels of the government, from the low-level folks to the mid-level folks. Typically, you're not going to see somebody at the higher level just because they've been around the block more than once.
So I think we have a question that actually relates to exactly what is being alleged here and what might be some of the issues with what Mr. Kushner left off his disclosures here. We have Richard in downtown. Richard, what's your question?
Yes, I don't see the big deal about him having clearance or not, because the President of the United States is his father-in-law, and in private, the president can tell him anything he wants to tell him because he definitely has top clearance. So I think it's a big issue over nothing myself. The president's going to tell him whatever he wants anyway.
Thank you, Richard. So, is that true? Is there an issue with what the president tells his family? I mean, I know that we've had discussions in the media ever since he was first putting his administration together that he has all these family members that are part of his administration. His daughter Ivanka Trump sat in on meetings with world leaders for him. Jared Kushner has been known to try to broker Middle East peace proposals. What is the What does the law say about what the president can or can't reveal to other people himself?
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. The security clearance process is one that is owned by the executive branch. And the final arbitrator of that by the executive orders of not just the past presidents, but Donald Trump will probably also pass his own executive order on the subject, he is the arbitrator. And so whether when we're talking about should Jared Kushner's clearance be pulled, it's another maybe. And the only person that can really decide that is the president, because he needs to determine whether Jared Kushner's role in the White House right now is of such national importance, and Jared Kushner gaining this information is such of national importance that he needs to keep his clearance. Now, a lot of on both sides of the aisle, they're making a lot of hay about this, and it's pretty much a political process. They're going to fundraise. They're going to be able to do things to talk to their base about this. However, one of the subjects that are kind of being brought up is there a double standard? And so if we were to strip away Jared Kushner's facts and kind of take it away from him, if Jared Kushner was a mid-level career employee of any of the agencies that need to traffic in security clearances, would he have his clearance at this point? And overwhelmingly likely he would not. And so I think a lot of politicians are picking up on, hey, look, this is just not fair. You have two sets of rules. So that's going to play out, and we'll kind of see how that goes. But ultimately, the caller is right. The president decides, and he can do whatever he wants.
So is this, I mean, for lack of a better way of portraying this, is this discussion kind of null at this point? I mean, what happens is decided by the president, and does anyone really believe, anyone who is calling for his security clearance to be removed, does anyone really believe that the president will? I mean, is this kind of a fight for naught?
I think it's a political it's a part of the political calculus, and we're going to keep on discussing this until kind of the president makes a decision, or Jared Kushner leaves the White House, or whatever happens. But it's political body blows that are being taken, and the White House really has no legal liability as far as allowing Jared Kushner to keep his clearance.
And that number is 549-2937. We'd like to take your calls on whether or not Jared Kushner's security clearance should be removed, and what security clearances generally are, and who controls them. Please give us a call. Do you think this is a big deal or just small potatoes? 549-2937. So let's talk about what the specifics behind the meeting that took place with this Russian lawyer who has some connections to the Kremlin. What makes it suspect at all that he had a meeting with this Russian lawyer, or now that we're learning this morning that he released in his own statement that he had a previously undisclosed meeting in April 2016 with Ambassador Kislyak for Russia? What makes that an issue?
So as far as the security clearance process, the issue is it being left off the security clearance forms. And we're seeing a statement being made by Jared Kushner, which I imagine was drafted by his attorneys, that basically starts pointing the blame. And the statement kind of alludes to a security clearance adjudication process that I don't think would be recognizable to anybody who's a career a civil servant or career military officer or non-commissioned officer, just because the process isn't one where you can accidentally send in your security clearance documents. That's just not how it goes. You fill out, like I said, a 100-page document. You have to sign it. There is some formality about it. That it's not just kind of like sending a tweet and you accidentally push the button and it's sent out. It's a deliberative process. So the fact that there are fingers being pointed, I think, is just going to start producing more questions than being answered at this point.
Now, what we have seen with these security clearances and also with financial disclosures by Kushner and other members of Trump's inner circle are these kind of amended forms that get filed. And we know from reporting locally on the case of former Congresswoman Corrine Brown that these amending these forms can be sort of routine until they're not. The amending of these forms, is it common at this level of government, these security clearance forms?
I would say that it is common. And in fact, the documentation and the executive orders command you to make updates when there is some type of significant event in your life, whether it be financial, through contacts, you could get married to a foreign person, all that type of stuff is certainly good. At this level, though, you have somebody that's at the highest level of government. They have hired an attorney just to fill out these documents. This shouldn't be something that mistakes are being made, and it should not be one that there needs to be routine amendments to.
So if you were going to be in that room, which I know a lot of me and a lot of my media colleagues would probably do a whole lot to be just a fly on the wall of the Senate Intelligence Committee meeting today, but What would be your first question if you were on the committee and you were talking to Mr. Kushner today about these omissions?
I think that my question really would be about the follow-up investigations. So when you fill out an SF 86, it's not like a piece of paper where the government just takes your word for it. They go ahead and they're going to go ahead and look, and they're going to research. And the statement that Jared Kushner produced today alludes to the fact that he has provided information to the FBI for that research. So there are collateral investigations. And so I'm curious to know who they talked to. And did they make any false statements? Because it is a closely held circle and a closely tied family, the Trumps are. So they're most likely going to go to under other family members to verify some of this information. And so what were their statements? Inherent in criminal and counterintelligence investigations is linking. So you have some people that were at this meeting in June of 2016 that most likely were on the radar of either the FBI or some other agency. Were they linked to Jared Kushner before we're even talking about SF-86? We don't know. And so I would definitely probe on that angle. And something that I would be very curious about is what are you working on right now? And so we talked about, should your clearance be pulled, Jared Kushner's clearance be pulled? What is it right now that you're working on that is such of national interest that you need to keep that clearance? Because all it is a distraction for everybody at this point. So that would definitely be my question.
Could he continue some of the work that he's doing as a member of the White House staff without that security clearance?
I think it would be very difficult, and it would be highly irregular. I think that the path forward there would probably be for the president to declassify some of this information. But as a journalist, once you declassify information, then people are going to try and get that information through a Freedom of Information Act request or something else. So it comes with some liabilities if they were going to do that.
All right. Well, Michael Stansky is a local attorney and an expert on security clearance issues. Mr. Stansky, thanks for joining us and walking us through this complicated and convoluted issue.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Back in a moment.
On the next Fresh Air, the frozen vault in the Arctic, where 933,000 samples of crop varieties are preserved. We talk with Carrie Fowler about creating the global seed vault where the world's biodiversity is protected in the event of climate extremes, pests, or war. His book is called Seeds on Ice. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Want to learn more about nutrition and weight loss? Join WJCT and Baptist Health for Girls Day Out Saturday, August 26th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Spend the day with experts that will engage you to be a better you. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, session, gift bag, and so much more. Tickets are just $40. Log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout and get your tickets today.
Join us as we celebrate a musical legacy that began more than a century ago. Blues Horizon, with the best in classic and modern blues, every Monday night at 11 p.m., only on 89.9 FM.
Summertime is learning time. WJCT and the Jacksonville Public Library are partnering to help families fight this summer slide with educational programming and online resources that encourage learning at home. Log on to wjct.org/education/summer to find summer reading lists, activity books, early literacy development tools, and much more. Help your child prepare for the new school year at wjct.org/education/summer.
Welcome back. The ARC Jacksonville is launching its newest employment initiative. For those that don't know, the ARC is a Jacksonville-based program that started in 1965 to provide education and other services to those with developmental disabilities. It's expanded over the years to include job training and placement, and thanks to $300,000 in new state funds, it's expanding yet again. ARC CEO Jim Whitaker and Steve Kelly with Everbank join me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So let's begin. Let's talk about what the ARC Jacksonville is. Give us a little bit of a history lesson.
Sure. The ARC Jacksonville is a not-for-profit, and we serve people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and really an array of services. We serve 500 people a day. We have a staff of 175. We do employment training. We actually have a college program at the University of North Florida. Just last year, we opened the ARC Jacksonville Village, which is a affordable apartment community off of Beach and Hodges Boulevard. We have group homes. We have advocacy services. We do just lots and lots of things to make people's lives work.
So tell me a little bit about this new employment initiative. Obviously, the ARC Jacksonville does a lot of job training and other initiatives like this. What makes this different?
Correct. Before we get into that, just kind of want to send out a shout to Senator Aaron Bean and Representative Travis Cummings. They were our two legislators that sort of championed this. It's a special appropriation, and Governor Scott approved it, and it is all about employment. The ARC Jacksonville has always been involved with employment options. Typically, they're individual placements, say somebody working at Publix or another community business. We decided we needed to put a new spin sort of on things. Actually, we're going to do a nationwide best practices search. So our staff are going to start visiting places throughout the country who actually look at employment a little bit differently. One of the models we're looking at is actually the possibility of the ARC Jacksonville opening our own businesses and employing groups of people alongside of individuals without disabilities. We have a number of people that can work, but they actually need more staff intervention, supervision, direction throughout their workday. So we're just kind of looking at things differently. And of course, individual placements are always going to happen. But we know we have a large population that can be employed, become taxpayers, and actually use their paycheck to help support themselves.
And I want to circle back to those. Those sound like some exciting new ideas. I want to circle back to that. But Mr. Kelly, can you explain to me what Everbank's involvement is here with the ARC Jacksonville and with this initiative specifically?
Well, I guess it kind of comes in from two different perspectives. First of all, we're very proud of the relationship that we have with ARC Jacksonville and have worked closely with Jim and his team on a number of different efforts, and so it's exciting for us to continue to work and build on what we've started there. But on the other side of things, EverBank has a strong program around diversity and inclusion and really trying to create an environment where people can fulfill their highest level of capabilities and, you know, create that kind of a work environment.
What are some of the barriers? I mean, there probably are more than a few that have gotten some attention in the media before, but explain to me a little bit more, Jim, what the barriers are for those with developmental disabilities who want to work and who want to have a 9-to-5 just like anyone else.
Right. Some of the barriers we see, and again, we're here to assist employers in trying to look at ways, you know, around those barriers. But some of the bigger corporations have policies which require, say, a high school education. Most of our individuals aren't going to have a high school education. You know, they went through special education, et cetera. So we try to look at how we can get into a business and maybe carve out a job. Maybe there's multiple people working in a corporate structure, and we can take a piece of what every one of those people do and actually make a job for somebody. So sometimes, too, just sort of the fear of the unknown. An employer doesn't know how that person may impact their workforce. But I think most of our individuals or employers that work with us will tell you it's only positive. Employees just wrap their arms around the individuals that come to work there, and it's just a great morale booster for everybody involved. But the bottom line is individuals can work, and they can be very, very productive under the right circumstances. And the great thing about our programs, we have staff to support the individual throughout their work period.
So tell me a little bit about, let's go back to the possible future expansion to this program. We're going to start off, the ARC is going to start off with about 5 or 6 individuals, right, with this initiative?
Well, actually, the first part, and we're beginning it now, is that nationwide best practices search. And just to throw out some maybes or possibilities, we do know that there are groups out there that have opened little cafes, restaurants. We're going to be looking at those models, car washes, all kinds of things that maybe we can bring those concepts back here and actually, you know, open businesses or work with existing businesses, such a car wash that already exists, requires a lot of manpower. We would send in a small group of people, 5 or 6 people, with one of our staff members throughout their workday. So let's say we're using an existing car wash. That car wash would employ the people we serve, making at least minimum wage or better. The ARC Jacksonville would employ the staff member there to give them direction and guidance. And also to the employer also has the option of contracting everything to the ARC Jacksonville, where we are the employer. So again, we can work with different situations, but we're looking at that where there's opportunities to have 4, 5 to 6 people working where we can actually send a staff member in. Could be in a warehouse, could be anywhere.
Steve, tell me a little bit about the possibility of EverBank kind of helping to fund or get these types of projects off the ground.
Well, beyond the financial support that we provide for ARC Jacksonville, which we're very happy and proud to be part of, we've partnered with ARC Jacksonville in the employment programs as well, and we've got a young man in our company who's like a celebrity, to be honest with you. He's such a great guy. Everybody loves him in the company, and he represents us well and does a lot of outreach for both ourselves and ARC Jacksonville, named Jason. And so we can certainly benefit from having more individuals through these work programs working at EverBank. And, you know, we kind of see it not only as the right thing to do for our associates and clients, but it really kind of gives us a competitive edge. So it's a little bit of a best kept secret that we're happy to share, because it truly is beneficial to the whole organization, you know, when we have such diversity amongst our ranks.
So have either of you, I want to know a little bit more about your personal stories. Steve, I'll start with you. Tell me a little bit about your first experience with helping an individual get a job like this. I mean, what was that like to witness?
Well, whenever you see somebody that has been held back for any reason, and, you know, it doesn't matter, there's discrimination of many different types amongst our society, unfortunately, but certainly when you see somebody who has such a positive attitude about life, but has been really unable to fulfill their potential, and now when you make that bridge and they're able to get that first job or to, you know, get that first paycheck or whatever, there's really nothing that compares with that to really kind of see somebody that's living up to what they see as their potential and what their true capabilities are. So, you know, we really try to find ways to do that in as many ways as possible. That's just what everybody deserves, and the community that's served by ARC Jacksonville certainly deserves that as well.
Unfortunately, Jim, it sounds like the barriers that we've talked about are actually put up by a lot of companies who may have a misunderstanding and think that people aren't capable of doing the kinds of jobs that they have open. Can you tell me a little bit about what it takes to remove that stigma and to change people's minds, employers specifically?
Well, number one, we'd like them to open the door just for conversation to begin with, and our staff will go in and talk to their management staff. And actually, I think one of the best opportunities for them then to talk to people at the EverBank or other companies that are employing individuals and get a firsthand sort of knowledge of what it's like to employ somebody. And again, I think everybody's going to find that it's very, very positive.
So to end off, tell us a little bit about what people can do to get involved with this specific initiative, but with the ARC Jacksonville in general. Either they need services themselves or maybe they just want to volunteer and help out. How can they get involved?
Sure. I'd like to also mention that the Jacks Chamber is behind this initiative. And to get more involved, go to our website, which is arcjacksonville.org. Or call our downtown office and ask for our employment services department. And the local phone number is 355-0155. Again, we're available, and we would very, very much like to sit down with potential employers and just show the many, many options that we can offer as far as employment.
All right, that's ARC CEO Jim Whitaker and EverBank's Steve Kelly. Thanks for being here, gentlemen. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Our pleasure.
And we'll be back with this week's sports with Cole Pepper. Stay tuned.
What is sex education like these days? Many parents cringe when talking to their kids about sex, and many kids don't want to discuss it with their folks. Teen pregnancy is down, but the Trump administration is cutting millions from a prevention program. How should we teach teenagers about sex, and who should lead the lesson? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Many people in Jacksonville never come in contact with those outside their core communities. WJCT is embarking on a journey called Beyond the Core to start a citywide conversation about what unites the people who call Duval County home and what makes our smaller communities unique. We might have an upcoming Beyond the Core listening event in your neighborhood. Check WJCTnews.org to find out.
Hi, I'm Mayor Lenny Curry. Planning ahead can save lives. To help you develop a plan to protect yourself and your family, visit JaxReady.com or download the JaxReady app and pick up a 2017 Hurricane Preparedness Guide at your public library. Tune your radio to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
This segment is brought to you by ServPro of Jacksonville South and of Arlington.
Welcome back. And finally this hour, Cole Pepper with this week's sports.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Golf's youngest superstar made more history at the British Open. Good morning, Cole.
Good morning, Ryan. Jordan Spieth turns 24 on Thursday, and yesterday he won his third different major when he raised the claret jug at the British Open. Spieth played the final five holes in 5-under par to beat Matt Kuchar by 2 strokes. In the process, Spieth became the 18th golfer to have won 3 different majors in his career. The other basically read like the list of the golfers you would bring up in an argument of the greatest golfers ever. Tiger Woods, Jack Nicklaus, Tom Watson, Phil Mickelson, Arnold Palmer among them. He also became just the second golfer ever to win 3 different majors before his 24th birthday. The only other man to do that, Jack Nicklaus. He's won 11 career tournaments and 3 Grand Slams. Compare that to what Tiger Woods and Nicklaus did at that age. At that age, Tiger had won 15 times, so a few more. Nicklaus had won 8, so 3 fewer. Pretty impressive. Spieth also ended the streak of first-time major winners. The past 8 majors had been won by players who had not won a major before. That could have continued had Kuchar, a former winner of the Players' Championship, won, but Spieth was just too good. What we're seeing right now is a great young golfer who has a chance to be one of the all-time greats if he keeps things up. Now, we've seen a lot of golfers look very good for short periods of time and not be able to sustain it, but Spieth has the kind of mental toughness that you would think might be able to become one of those all-time greats. If he wins the PGA in August, he would become just the 6th man ever to win the career Grand Slam, and he would be the youngest to accomplish it. Also in Europe, by the way, Chris Froome won the Tour de France for the 3rd straight year. It's the 4th time in 5 years that the Englishman has won.
Okay, well, let's take a closer look at home. The Jaguars will open training camp this week. What will you be looking for?
Yeah, the Jaguars rookies and quarterbacks have already reported, and the rest of the veterans are due in on Wednesday. The first practice is Thursday, and clearly there are some big topics here. But the first one that I'll be looking at is how camp is going to be under Doug Marrone as the head coach and how it differs from what we've seen under Gus Bradley. I expect a much more old-school approach with Marrone, who's kind of cut from the same cloth as Tom Coughlin. While Gus Bradley did what he could to take the stress off players, remove distractions, make things as easy as possible, Marrone is likely to try to put pressure on players to see how they handle it and see how they react. The Jaguars placed 2 cornerbacks on the physically unable to perform list in advance of camp, Jalen Ramsey and Aaron Colvin. This is basically a procedural move. Both players can still be at camp, but they can't practice while they are recovering from injuries. They can be made active at any time. As for how you can experience training camp, it is free, but fans must register in advance at the Jaguars website. You can park in lots M and N, and there'll be concessions and merchandise for sale as well. Also a good way for the kids to get autographs with the players. Practices are open to the public Thursday and Friday this week, and Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of next week. The next Friday, it's the annual scrimmage inside Everbank Field that is also open to the public.
And we have some soccer news with the Armada, right?
The Armada begin the fall season a week from yesterday when they host the San Francisco Deltas at UNF's Hodges Stadium. The Armada are in position to challenge for a postseason spot if they play as well in the fall as they did in the spring. The match will also be the first match since Robert Palmer completed the deal to purchase the team as the new owner. And the Jumbo Shrimp, a long road trip coming up. They're on the road until August the 4th.
Well, thanks as always, Cole.
Thanks, Ryan.
You can hear more from Cole on the Sam and Cole podcast. You can also subscribe on iTunes and follow him on Twitter at Cole Pepper.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show's theme is composed and performed by Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app to listen anytime. I'm Ryan Bank in for Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be back again 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.